Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson. The issue before us as investors are as daunting today as they can possibly be. And my position has been that today we're all speculators, not investors, because we've been placed in the uncomfortable position of trying to guess what the central banks are going to do next. Also weighing on investors today is the fact that our official data is what I call fuzzy. That is, it's often statistically massaged to make things look a little bit rosier than they otherwise might. To help us sort through both of these investment challenges is Charles Biederman, founder, chief executive officer of Trim Tabs Investment Research, an independent investment research firm based in Sausalito, California. He is routinely interviewed on all the big financial media and is someone I follow quite closely because his approach is to follow the base data and let that tell the story. Founded in 1990, Trim Tabs Investment Research is the leading independent institutional research firm focused on the supply and demand of shares and stock and money available for investment. That base data, I really want to get to that today. Welcome, Charles. It's a real pleasure to have you as a guest today.
Well, good to be with you.
Thanks. Hey, let's begin with your background so that people can appreciate first the depth of your knowledge and experience, and then why it is that you follow the fundamental data sources that you do.
You mean you want me to fess up that I'm really very old?
If that's how you want to approach it, sure.
Well, my first job after graduating Harvard Business School was not what everybody does. I became Alan Abelson's assistant at Barron's Financial Weekly. Hmm. And so it was a terrific postgraduate education in how the markets really work. And from there, I ended up having to become an entrepreneur because Harvard wanted me to repay my student loans at the time, which you couldn't do on a journalist salary. So I actually had been predicting a collapse in the REITs market in the early 1970s, so all the money had gone in, and then huge amount of construction, and interest rates in 1973 went from 7% to 20% as the first energy price shock hit. And oil prices went from $3 a barrel to $30. And so I participated in the collapse of the real estate market, then bought bunches of properties, 6 shopping centers, 1,000 apartments, 2 office buildings out of foreclosure in the South when I was in my late 20s. Moved back to New York, ended up going broke in 87. When the real estate market, sold most of the stuff in the South, reinvested in Jersey, and when the REITs and the banks collapsed, or the SNLs collapsed, I mean, in 87, my banks went under. I had a positive net worth, but I was forced to declare bankruptcy, and I realized that price is a function of liquidity having nothing to do with value. If I wasn't foreclosed on, I could have sold my properties for a nice profit, but my banks went under, and the banks were, and all the loans were called. So using that background, I decided to look at the markets based on supply and demand and realized no one had ever been looking at the stock market in terms of, well, there is in the market is shares of stock, and there's money available to buy those shares. And so that's what we've been tracking ever since.
Well, I like that idea a lot, that price is a function of liquidity, not fundamental value. So let's move now to some of that data and what it's telling us, and that might be different from what both, I guess, two things I want to track today if we have the time. One is how our official unemployment numbers maybe are tracking differently from the base tax data, but for now I'd like to start with what stocks are signaling. Hey, they're just 10% away from their all-time highs. We're looking at that. Is this truth or fiction?
Well, if the Fed and the other globe central banks hadn't created or $10 trillion of paper money since 2009, we wouldn't be talking about a stock market 10% below the all-time high. Since last October, last 6 months, the value of all stocks is up like almost $4 trillion. Hmm. And since last October, the increase in take-home pay for everybody who pays taxes on a job is up maybe $200 billion at a $200 billion annual rate of increase. So we're talking about a huge increase in wealth only for people who own stocks. And why did that happen? Well, the Fed pumped huge amounts of money into the economy. Companies ended up with a huge amount of cash on their balance sheet. And starting in August, they've been spending huge amounts of money, $1.8 billion a day net of all new share sales, buying back their own shares. In other words, they're reducing the number of shares out there, giving shareholders cash for their holdings. And so shareholders, 80% of the Russell 1000, the largest companies, are held by institutions. And those institutions typically have the same 3% cash. So if someone buys back their shares, they have to replace those shares. So there's more money chasing fewer shares. So, supply and demand, more money chasing fewer shares, the price of the remaining shares should go up.
So the many of these companies have been tapping the capital markets as well for debt, have been, obviously generational interest rate low. So they've had access to this liquidity, which is coming through the Fed. What did you say, $1.8 billion a day?
$1.8 billion a day since August.
Wow. Where's the retail investor been in this story?
Taking their money out and spending it probably on living.
And what? How do those money flows track? How do they compare?
Well, we've seen outflows from U.S. equity mutual funds. I was just talking before we spoke with Bob Pisani from CNBC, him wanting to know when are individuals coming back. And I said, well, they came back in the first quarter of last year and then got slammed as the market sold off in April. Last year the market was up over 10% the first 4 months and then got slammed. This year the market's up over 10% and individuals are saying, hey, I've seen this movie already. I don't want to, this sequel isn't appealing to them.
Well, in the work I do, I get to interact with a lot of people who are investors, and there's a fundamental lack of faith out there. There's actually more than that. There's fear. There's concern that the markets are rigged in some important ways, that there's asymmetry of information, that the computerized bots, whatever it is that's going on out there, maybe that the regulators are not really watching out for everybody with equal interest. Whatever the source of fear is, I know a lot of people have lost faith in the markets, but not the institutions apparently, and not the companies who are buying back shares, huh?
Well, the market's rigged. I mean, in January of 10, I went on, I said on CNBC and on Bloomberg, that there's no money coming into stocks, and yet the stock market keeps going up. The law of supply and demand still exists, and for stock prices to go up, there has to be more money buying those shares. Mm-hmm. There's no other way in aggregate that could happen. So I said it had to be coming from the government, and everybody thought I was a lunatic, a conspiracy theorist, whatever. And then, lo and behold, in October of 2011, Mr. Bernanke says officially that the purpose of QE1 and QE2 is to raise asset prices. Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, equities are an asset, and bonds are an asset. So asset prices have gone up as the Fed has been manipulating the market, at the same time as the economy is not growing. Are not growing very fast, or growing roughly at the rate of inflation. And I'm talking about wages and salaries. I totally ignore GDP because it's a ridiculous number if anybody looked at it. And the only reason everybody uses it is because everybody doesn't understand what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And no one wants to do the work to understand that GDP is a useless indicator. So we look at wages and salaries. Real-time income, to me, is the best indicator of income.
Yeah, what a preposterous notion. But since we're there, what are wages and salaries telling us right now?
Wages and salaries are growing at between a half, under 1% faster than inflation. Wages and salaries in our most recent data, like 3.5%, 3.7, in that range. And inflation is, whatever, 2.9, 3, pick a number. So if nominal wages and salaries for everybody who has who has income taxes and employment taxes withheld from their paychecks, which is all 132 million people on the payroll, included in the payroll survey by the VLS, an emphasis on the word survey, that wages and salaries are barely growing. In reality, we're about at $6.3 trillion after-tax income for everybody. Well, that's up from $5.9 trillion at the annual rate at the early 2009 low. It's still well below the $7.1 trillion peak in 07. $7.1 trillion take-home pay for everybody who pays taxes. And the gap between the two right now is still capital gains have disappeared as the real estate market disappeared. And, you know, the Bureau of Economic Analysis does not include capital gains in their income data because, well, it's only dirty capitalists who have capital gains, I guess. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. All right. So in this,
I don't know why they don't include it.
All right. Well, we don't include the increase in debt when subtract that off of our GDP. So I don't know. Maybe we just ignore very big things sometimes.
Well, they go use that bogey again.
Yeah,
GDP.
I know. With the fourth quarter deflator at 0.8%, that's all I need to know about that number. It's obviously very far off of my personal experience, but also what I think a lot of very solid inflation data is coming to us through the companies that actually have to buy things and report their cost of goods sold. We're seeing some extraordinary inflation, especially on the commodity-exposed companies out there, double-digit, 10, 11% kind of stuff. It's amazing.
Well, if you think about it, the dollar is being debased by the printing of a hundred, the U.S. government is spending $300 billion a month on everything. It pays bills, salaries. It collects $200 billion a month in taxes and everything else, and it borrows $100 billion a month. But it doesn't really borrow $100 billion a month because $100 billion is added to the debt. It prints $100 billion and calls that debt.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I'd like to be able to run my business by printing money to pay my bills, a third of them. That would be good.
I would, too. So in their collection, you mentioned the $200 billion a month that is coming in. Talk to me very quickly, if you could, talk to us about the tax receipts and what those are signaling. And can we compare those to the unemployment figures that have been released and reported?
Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and the Department of Census use 1960 technology surveys and of the present compared to hard data from the past, the same way they've done this for 40 years to determine income, sales, consumer discretionary spending, the savings rate. All those numbers are fudgy at best, to use your phrase, since they ignore real-time data. Like, they do, the Bureau of Labor Statistics does a survey of 400,000 employers, of which, say, 70%, only 70% is back by the time they report the number of jobs for the month. And they true that survey to hard data that comes from state quarterly unemployment insurance collections, which is a quarterly number that gets to the BLS the soonest is 5 months at the from the end of a certain quarter. 5 months later, the BLS gets the valid number, and then it benchmarks the past to that data. So, in other words, the real numbers that they use is just a survey, and it can get 50 to 100% modified a year later. And nobody even realizes or even, those numbers are pretty much ignored, but everybody focuses on their initial guesstimate, which even they say is not meant to be considered a real number. Nevertheless, the Wall Street Journal says, 200,000 jobs have been created. Like, that's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And not even that it's a seasonally adjusted number, which is another chance for mischief, because to do seasonal adjustments, you have to get, why don't you use year-over-year numbers and forget seasonal adjustments? And why don't you use, and so, to, I'm sorry, I'm going all over the place, but to go back to the wages and salaries we track, when anybody who's on a job that gets a W-2, when the amount of income and employment taxes are withheld from our paychecks, it gets wired to the Treasury and from our banks. And when that money gets wired to the Treasury, they report how much they collected. And so we track that data. It's reported in the Daily Treasury Statement with a lot of other daily Treasury activities. However, embedded in that income and employment tax collection package is how many people were working, what was gross pay, what was take-home pay.
Mm-hmm.
And by by zip code, so you have, and by industry classification. So you have this huge amount of real-time data on what's really going on in the economy available but ignored. And when I've been, you know, for 6 years I've been saying, why do you ignore this? And their answer pretty much is, mind your own business. We don't care what you think. And this is the way we've been doing it. And we like our paychecks. Thank you very much.
So this data, though, I love the idea of real-time data. Are there flaws in this? What are the wrinkles in this data set? Or are
you
these wrinkles?
The well, there's a lot. It's a survey. And
no, not the BLS one, but in the Daily Treasury Statement, the W-2 flows.
Well, it has to be. We only get what the actual amount withheld. There's three reasons why the amount withheld year over year would change. One is that the people with jobs made more money, so the amount of withholding goes up. Two, mm-hmm. the people with jobs might have changed bracket because they made more money, and so they're at a higher bracket. That's called bracket creep.
Mm-hmm.
Three, people, there might be more employees or less employees as people get hired and fired. So each month, on average, 4 million people enter and leave the job market.
Right.
In other words, on average, 4 people are fired, 4 million people are fired, 4 million people are hired. And then in January and February, there are huge seasonal adjustments because of the weather. And so based upon, like, 1.7 million seasonal adjustment adds, in other words, there's the, according to the geniuses at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they add 1.7 million phantom jobs to those people working in February to balance, you know, to make it like a level number with the rest of the year. And why 1.7 million? Well, based on the past, that's our best guess. And the fact that the weather was so great this winter, that doesn't, you know, they'll factor that in next year when the numbers will be worse, because whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So does that make sense what I'm saying?
Absolutely. So on the one hand, we have this survey, which is seasonally adjusted on top of that. And on the other hand, we have this base data, which might change for a number of reasons. Bracket creep, people might actually be earning more in that case, or hiring, firing, things like that. But generally speaking, we have these two things that we can compare. One is a survey that's adjusted, and the other is this W-2 income flow statement stuff that comes through the Daily Treasury Statement. What is that data telling us right now?
That the economy is limping along. It's barely growing. And if it wasn't for levitating equity and very low bond prices, it probably would be even slower than it is. So in reality, all it looks to me what this $100 billion creation of new money a month has been creating $200 billion a year increase in take-home pay. Now, isn't that weird? It takes $100 billion months of newly created paper to boost take-home pay by, you know, or $1 trillion. The deficit this year is going to be $1.3 trillion, I think, mm-hmm. is the current estimate. And it takes $1.3 trillion of newly created money to boost take-home pay by $200 billion. What's wrong with this?
There's some sort of a hole in the boat, I guess.
You know, and if they stop the deficits or... And then now they want to increase taxes next year by about $200 billion to plug the deficit. So wait a second. So incomes are up by $200 billion, and these smart people want to reduce incomes by $200 billion to raise taxes. And the stock market is within 10% of all-time highs. There's logic there, isn't there?
Well, so this creates that growing sense of anxiety in the investor class, because obviously there is something that just doesn't quite add up here. And just to switch, open our view up just a tiny bit, jump across the pond for a second, is Europe fixed?
Well, if by fixed you mean guaranteed to go down the toilet, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Europe is, The problem, I mean, in Greece, the numbers I've read, doing some Google, is that of the a little over 11 million Greeks still left who haven't emigrated, close to 3 million are retired, and half of everybody else works for the government.
And, of course, with the austerity, they're talking about slashing pensions and squeezing
and
government salaries
and pay. And Spain and Portugal, half the people under 25 apparently are unemployed. And what does that say for the future stability of that region?
Well, a generation lost? I don't know if that's a good thing or not. You know, my prescription on all of this years ago was that we suffered from something I can summarize in three words, which was too much debt. And this is a decades-long phenomenon that's been building.
Well, no, I don't think it's really too much debt. I think it's the fundamental belief that government can be effective at providing cradle-to-grave or even any services for its people. And all, even that it's, name me one activity that government has ever been cost-effective at providing one service. I mean, the post office, fighting a war.
National highway system?
Look at these horrible tragedies. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are being killed because this government thinks it knows how to fight wars.
Mm-hmm. Well, so when I say too much debt, what I mean is, well, I do think in aggregate it was too high, but I was watching our economy, both at the private and the public levels, increasing its debt loads at a faster rate than nominal GDP growth, if we wanted to use that bogey right there. But however we track national income, we were increasing our debts faster than our income was increasing. And that's a math problem. Sooner or later, that thing runs out of steam. And it wasn't just the U.S. It turns out a lot of Europe was doing that, and Japan was a poster child for that. And it seems to be a phenomenon that's quite easy to fall into at the national, even global level.
I don't disagree with the facts as you state them, but if you go back to why, if you go back to, like, starting in 82, when the IBM PC, or the personal computer, first showed up, through 07, you had a period of very rapid economic growth globally. Incomes grew very rapidly. You had PC, the internet, broadband, all that stuff. So when incomes grow rapidly, people take on more debt because, oh, look, my income's going up, I can borrow more. So you take on more debt, and then all of a sudden incomes crash, and you've taken on all this debt because we kept assuming that our incomes would grow so we could handle the debt service. But the problem with assuming incomes are going to keep growing, if they stop growing, you're broke.
Well, sooner or later, you're going to have a slowdown, right?
So that's my point. My point is it's not just income growth by itself, but it was income growth. I mean, debt growth supported by rapid income growth, but then the income growth disappeared.
Yep. Yeah. So let's pretend I'm an investor, which I happen to be. What does an investor do in this market, particularly if they've kind of – I've lost faith in a number of dimensions. One, that our official data is telling me useful things that I can trust. And the second would be that the markets are operating in a fundamentally fair way, meaning – you know where I lost it was when I watched the big banks turn in 100% win ratios off of their trading desks for whole quarters. Anything that has even the slightest bit of risk in it, you can't have a 100% win ratio in it. It's statistically off the charts.
Unless the market's rigged.
So I could go on. I have many other data points that suggest rigging is happening. So if we take that as an opening proposition that the Fed is basically saying, listen, we're going to do whatever it takes to get higher asset prices, should an investor just say, okay, I'm along for the ride and follow? Or how does somebody protect themselves against what seems to be a very, very risky proposition? If the Fed either succeeds or fails at this, and if they fail, it's easy to conjure up some fairly dark scenarios for wealth destruction, I think.
Well, we're going to be starting a retail newsletter where we're going to sell. I'm going to sell my $10 a week, $9.99. Charles Biederman buying, selling, and thinking about the market. And so, if this were that, and the preamble to all this is right now. Well, you have a situation where, in reality, the economy is not growing very fast, but money is, paper money is. So a third of my assets are in gold, and a small percentage of that in silver. but mostly gold. Mm-hmm. And then given all that money printing has to end up in inflation at some point in time, I have about a third of my assets in inflation-protected securities.
Mm-hmm.
And then since companies are shrinking the float and grow, we started a fund called TrimTabs Float Shrink ETF, traded on the New York Stock Exchange, ticker symbol TTFS, and it invests in the 100 companies that are shrinking the trading float the most, growing free cash flow and not borrowing to buy. So the average company in our portfolio is growing free cash flow at 11% a year, using shrinking the trading float by 6.5% on an annualized basis, and while maintaining a strong balance sheet. So we believe that the price of the share should go up by, you know, in my opinion, by 6% a year, even without more than the market, simply because those companies, the value of those companies, hasn't been diminished by the float shrink. If that makes any sense.
It does.
So
yeah.
If you're a long term investor, and I think that we're 3 to 5 years from the market bottoming. But I would still recommend buying stock if you have a longer than a 5-year time horizon on a monthly basis. And that's the type of equity exposure I would want. I also own some Apple and some Salesforce.com. Apple, mm-hmm. because, you know, the social media trend is everybody's using Apple. And Salesforce.com is the most effective cloud participant. And those are two big growth areas, because I think the globe is going to continue to expand economically, but it's got this albatross of government-created messes around our necks.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still have, even though I have a big loss, I have a small position in shorting the big banks, shorting Europe, and shorting the emerging markets, but totaling like 15% of my portfolio. So I'm a little bit leveraged, and the leverage is the short, which I'm losing money on, but I'm also making money on the other stuff.
Right, so that's your hedge in essence.
Yeah, I think at some point when companies stop buying back shares and start selling more than they're buying, the market's going to crack regardless of what the Fed does, or at least initially.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to have some shorts in the water, just in case I want to increase my exposure.
Okay. Big macro question then, because a big exogenous risk here is that the government, U.S. government, has to fund $1.3 trillion a year. The Fed's been enabling that with their liquidity. Do you see anything out there that could force the hand of the Fed and the federal government, meaning is there any circumstance you can imagine coming in the next year where the vaunted bond market could rebel? But what I really mean is that foreign participation in our bond markets would dry up, and there would be some set of pressures that would prevent the Fed from doing QE 3, 4, 5, whatever is necessary. Is there anything you could see that could create that kind of a risk? Because I still note that roughly 10% of our current GDP is deficit spending by the federal government, maybe 8%, I guess, if I'm being a little bit more accurate. But, you know, it's a pretty high number. Do you see anything that could possibly upset that gravy train as a real risk?
Yes, I think it will be. At some point, the world's going to recognize the emperor's naked. The only question is when. Will it be this year? I don't think it'll be before the election. I think there's too much vested interest in keeping things rosy and positive, and I just don't see it happening soon. However, at some point, hard money wins out over phony money, and the investor class, or the capital, those with capital, which right now seems to be the emerging markets, they're buying gold and bullion, and they're not buying dollars. Or China appears to have slowed their buying of dollars, even though China might be having their own growth problems or their own bad debt problems. But Singapore and all those other countries with huge cash flows, the emerging world, you know, I wouldn't be surprised maybe by 2013 or 2014, a non-U.S. dollar alternative currency by those countries might, you know, something will happen.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, a market that's fundamentally running on fumes, or in this case, liquidity, which you call, the funny money coming out. This is not a market my grandfather would recognize at all. And
This is a totally unique market. We've never before had a market officially rigged and acknowledged as such. And what's amazing to me is when you watch CNBC or even Bloomberg TV, and these guys come on bullish, they look at PEs. Well, the PE for, what was the PE the last time the market was rigged?
We don't know.
And what happens when the market is unrigged?
Right.
We're in strange, uncharted territory. The last thing I want to say that I think is very important for people to realize, in 1981, before the market crossed 1,000, the Dow crossed 1,000 in early 82 and stayed above that, the value of all U.S. stocks was about $800 billion. And in October of 07, it peaked at 22 point something trillion. And it's back up to 19.4 trillion. So in 1981, there was maybe 100 hedge funds or less, I'm sure less, and maybe 100 or so equity mutual funds, and 3,000 stocks of institutional size of sorts back then. Now there's still 3,000 stocks, but there's 4,500 equity mutual funds, 10,000 hedge funds. The real wealth created in the last 30 years has been in the equity market. Not in earnings. I mean, earnings are up several times. Yeah, four or five times. Take-home pay is up. But the market's up 19, 20 times.
Mm-hmm. Yep, on the back of all those boomers entering their peak earning years and pushing all that money into equity markets was one force.
And we had technology breakthroughs.
Mm-hmm.
Internet, broadband, more people in the last 30 years have gone from calorie insufficiency to calorie sufficiency as a percentage of the population than, going back to the first time we industrialized in the 19th century. So it's like this huge increase in wealth and calories, and all across the globe, a lot of that money went into the real estate markets and went into the equity markets and boosted home prices and stock prices dramatically, and now it's unwinding. All booms create excesses, and excesses are painful as the excesses from the boom are worked off and worked out, and that's the process we're in. And in the past, it's taken 13 to 17 years to work off those excesses, and we're still not even through year five.
Well, in the past, I think we also allowed some of that creative destruction to happen, and this time we're fighting that tooth and nail.
You can't fight that forever.
Right, can't fight that forever. So, as a final question, then, I'm wondering, it feels like we're kind of, at least when it comes to deficit spending, and then also with the QE efforts and the central balance sheet expansion of the central banks, that we're on a treadmill I don't know how we get off of. So the question is, if the central banks were going to get us back on a right path, what would they be doing that they aren't doing right now?
Well, they would have cut mark-to-market early on. And kept reserve currency at a dollar, kept the financial markets going, but let the big banks go bust. And if the top five had gone under, then the next five would now be the big banks, and the real estate market would have recovered. You got to mark to market the bad stuff. We've been reluctant, like Japan, which still hasn't marked to market from its 1990 debacle. We're refusing to mark to market. So when you maintain phony levels, you restrict overall growth, and you harm the overall economy, but you save the jobs of the big bankers and the politicians who created the messes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we're at. The only people benefiting are equity holders, and it's temporary, as well as the big banks. And at some point, gravity does work eventually. Even Wile E. Coyote had to come back to Earth sooner or later.
Well,
if those of you who are old enough to remember that cartoon character.
Everybody knows Wile E. Coyote, I hope, no matter how old they are. What you're saying, then, is that you think we're going to perpetuate the status quo until there's some sort of a forcing function, gravity in this case, of some kind.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Well, this has been a very fascinating, insightful, and actually very pleasurable interview for me, and I'm hoping we can do it again sometime. How do people follow your work and, in particular, find out about this new newsletter that sounds real intriguing?
TrimTabs.com blog is our blog site. Mm-hmm. I do a video 4 or 5 days a week. Three, 4 days a week, I mean, and there's other stuff on our blog site, including access to our ETF for more information, and we'll be posting information about the new market letter sometime in the next month.
Well, fantastic. I'm looking forward to that personally, and this has been very interesting, and I'm thankful that you look at the data the way you do and make it available to all of us.
You're welcome.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.